are listening to the Mythmaker Podcast Network.
Welcome to the Joseph Campbell Foundation podcast, Pathways with Joseph Campbell. I'm your host, Bradley Olson. As you know, on this podcast, we share archived audio lectures given by Campbell over the course of his teaching and lecturing career. Today, we're listening to a lecture Campbell gave at the Cooper Union in 1966, which would have made him somewhere in his 62nd year. The title of the lecture is Mythology and Folklore. And, as is sometimes the case, I'm unsure why the archivist chose this for the title, as there's no real direct reference to folklore in the lecture. The reason and the archivist, for that matter, are lost to modern JCF memory. But as usual, I have a theory, and we'll discuss that later in my commentary. The lecture you're about to hear was given as a part of a series of lectures by Professor Campbell and other scholars. The Cooper Union for the Advancement of Science and Art, as it's formally known, is a private university in Lower Manhattan situated at a confluence of neighborhoods that include the Bowery, Greenwich Village, the East Village, and the Lower East Side. The institute was named after Peter Cooper, a 19th century industrialist and philanthropist, after his death in 1883. In 1853, Cooper broke ground for the Cooper Union as an institution founded on the belief that high-quality education should be available to all who qualified, including women, a radical notion at the time, without cost. It continued, I have to say, remarkably, to provide every student with a full tuition scholarship until 2014. Cooper Union is famous for its invited speakers. Most notably, of course, was a relatively unknown Midwestern politician named Abraham Lincoln. After his Cooper Union address was lauded and printed in the nation's newspapers, Lincoln became an overnight sensation. He himself credited the speech as the single greatest reason for his election as the 16th President of the United States. Every time I hear Johnson E. Fairchild introduce Joseph Campbell, and we've had a number of those occasions on this podcast, I can't help but smile and, well, feel good. Information and photographs of Fairchild are hard to come by, but the picture that comes to my mind is that of a large, avuncular, extraordinarily extroverted man, a man absolutely in love with the idea of learning, and perhaps even more importantly, a man utterly devoted to and in love with his fellow humans. I wish we could all have the experience of being treated. No, treated isn't quite the right word. Of being seen, of being appreciated, even loved in the way Campbell is by Dr. Fairchild. It certainly wasn't lost on Campbell. He acknowledged the special gift that Fairchild gave him and recognized the extraordinary blend of friendship, scholarly support, and professional promotion he received. You may have come across one of Professor Campbell's attempts to repay Fairchild's efforts on his behalf. Dr. Fairchild wrote the foreword to the popular Campbell book, Myths to Live By. And in his preface of the book, Campbell wrote, and I'm quoting from the book now, "I'm happy indeed that Dr. Fairchild has very kindly agreed to introduce the volume, as he introduced from the platform every one of its talks. The last, delivered on the last evening before retirement of his long career as both chairman of the forum and director of the Department of Adult Education at the Cooper Union. I think of this collection as an appropriate token of my debt and gratitude to him for the encouragement, warm friendship, and always timely suggestions of themes and titles that taught me to bring my buffalo gods, Quetzalcoatl's, Buddhas and fairy queens into mutually illuminating dialogue with those hundreds of members of his audience, many of them faithful for years, who were finally the inspiration for these talks. My thanks go out to all of them, as well as to their chairman. Unquote. And Fairchild was no slouch as a mythologist, actually. He wrote the excellent 1959 book, Basic Beliefs, a simple presentation of the religious philosophies of mankind. His character seemed to perfectly embody the philosophical spirit of the Roman playwright Terence, whose work, Heauton Timoroumenos, The Self-Hater, gives us this essential humane maxim. I am human. Nothing that is human is alien to me. In that humanistic vein, Fairchild also edited a collection called Personal Problems and Psychological Frontiers, and yet another called Women, Society, and Sex. In his foreword to Myths to Live By, Dr. Fairchild wrote this, and I'm reading from the text. One of my precepts during my 22 years at the Cooper Union has been that every one of the more than 1,000 whom I have invited to speak or perform and have presented on the platform should be my friend, as should every member both of the visible audience and of the millions of invisible radio listeners. It would be difficult to select a single speaker, but Joseph Campbell, the author of the present book, epitomizes the quality of communication and intellectuality required for the forum. He never uses a note, speaks beautifully, and is brilliant. Above all, he transmits ideas that bridge the past and future in the worlds of East and West. He has delivered at the forum many great lectures and lecture series, and they have always been a joy and a pleasure. The present work, developed from those lectures, synopsizes a lifetime of scholarship and the best principles of the Cooper Union Forum. I am proud to be a part of this momentous book. Well, that certainly captures the sentiments of most of us who have spent time reading and considering the works of Joseph Campbell. And I can think of no better introduction than that. So I'll return a little bit later with some commentary on Campbell's lecture. And without further delay, here's Joseph Campbell.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the Cooper Union Forum. This is your chairman, Johnson E. Fairchild, speaking to you from the Great Hall of the Cooper Union, where we are opening our new series on the emergence of mankind. And I think quite fittingly, we are opening this series with myth and folklore and the magnificent speaker, Professor Joseph Campbell, Professor of Literature, Sarah Lawrence College. The professor is much more than that. He is a great teacher. And he has lectured here before and in many places, and he is just unique in the field in his ability to communicate. I will just mention that he did go to school once to Dartmouth and to Columbia, I believe. He had University of Munich, Paris, where he has won numerous honors. And he is author of many important books, but I will just mention several, and such as A Skeleton Key to Finnegan's Wake, The Hero with a Thousand Faces, and for the last 12 years, he has been working on his great series, The Masks of God. As many of you know, three volumes are now out. Primitive Mythology, Oriental Mythology, Occidental Mythology, and now he is just in the middle of his last volume on modern folklore mythology. There are many other fine things I could say about Mr. Campbell, but he's here to talk to you, and that's very important. Mr. Joseph Campbell.
Ladies and gentlemen, it's a great pleasure. It's always a great pleasure to talk to the Cooper Union Forum. The topic tonight, mythology and folklore, is particularly appropriate for the great theme of this Monday evening series, the emergence of mankind, because it is coeval with mankind. That is to say, as far as the evidence of our species, Homo sapiens, goes, in its beginnings, we can see that mythological motifs were already present in the minds of earliest men. Furthermore, it tells us something about the unity of our species, the unity of its problems, the unity of its way of thinking, feeling, and experiencing. Because the chief theme, the chief motifs of this great body of law are constant, are universal throughout the history and extent of the human species. Now, when we think of the emergence of mankind, we may think of this in physical terms, in terms of the peculiar traits of our species, which distinguishes it from the other primates, the erect posture, the great brain, the active, as they say, apposital thumb, which gives us hands that can manipulate tools and so forth. But when we think of the psychological aspect of our species, that which distinguishes us psychologically from the other primates, our cousins, what we can recognize through the motifs of mythology that have been characteristic of our race is a problem that other animals, other primates, do not know. It is the problem of the individual conscious of himself as such, aware of the fact that he and that all he knows and cares for are to die. This facing of death, this recognition of what might be called the problem of mortality, is the great theme of mythology. Along with that, there is another great theme, that of this individual becoming integrated with his group in its character as a living entity which protects him, within which he lives, and at a certain period of his life, which he must protect. That is to say, not only does the individual, conscious of himself as such, face death, but he also faces this problem of the social world in which he is raised, into which he is bred. Now, as you know, all mankind faces death. But the different societies have quite specific characteristics which differentiate them one from another. The young person growing up in a primitive hunting community has a very different world to face and into which to become integrated than the young person growing up in this complex industrial world today. Or, between these two extremes, there's the world of the peasant, the agrarian societies, which come into being about 8,000 BC in the Near East for the first time. The society has to train up its young people to function in the terms necessary for life in these specifically different communities. And so, while we have on the one hand a universalizing constant problem and theme system in the mythologies of the world, we also have specific foci, specific focuses appropriate to the different culture contexts. And then there is still another problem that the ego, the individual, becomes aware of as he matures. And that is his relationship to a great cosmos, to a universe, the problem of this world in which he finds himself, its mystery, its magnitude. And the view of the universe changes also in time, as our instruments of research, as our modes of knowledge are matured. And so here is another changing factor. We have then certain constant factors that we will recognize in reviewing the myths, and we have also certain changing factors which seem to differentiate the mythologies one from another. And now in the course of the development of the human species and its great move into distance in the early centuries, the different branches of our species became separated from each other. And so there were differentiations in the interpretations of the universal motifs. But as we now are coming together again with this great period of transport and communication, the differences are fading. And a point I want to make, and that I think is going to become clear during the course of these weeks, is that the old differences separating one mythological system from another are now becoming less and less important. And what is becoming important is that we should see through these differences to the common themes which have been there all the time, came into being with our species and remained with us. Now there's just another point I want to make. As I say in the beginning, the individual and his group saw themselves in relation to death on the one hand and the great mystery of the cosmos on the other. Now we are becoming more and more able to take society for granted. It is becoming more and more and efficient. It doesn't always seem that way, I must say, particularly at election time. But it's becoming a more and more efficient machine that is being conducted in a competent way, not by guesswork, but by long seasoned knowledge. The principles of justice and law and so forth are becoming gradually established. And now what we find is, instead of trying to protect the society is coming along pretty well, we are shifting our emphasis from the protection of the society to the development of the individual. And this is a very important shift that I want to speak about a little later in this talk. Now, with respect to the interpretations of mythology, let me take as an example the first chapters of the book of Genesis. The traditional way of interpreting these chapters in the history of our biblically based Western tradition, the traditional way of interpreting these is historically. It used to be said that they represented an actual historical account, that there was a creation of the world in 7 days, that there was a Garden of Eden with a serpent there who could talk, and that Eve was drawn from Adam's rib, and that the serpent talked to Eve and said, "Now this tree, which you have been told not to eat of, would do you a great deal of good. You would get to know a good deal about this, and about the world, and about things that God thinks he has a monopoly on." And you know the story. There was the fall, and then the expulsion from the garden, and all these sorrows of the world. Now, until very recently, it was thought possible that there had been such a garden. Throughout the 19th century, we still hear of this. But now, as a result of the researches of our archaeologists and our geologists, we know that there was no such thing. There was no Garden of Eden. There was no time when the serpent could talk. There was no flood. There was no Noah's Ark. The whole thing is an anthology of fictions. But these are fictions that have, curiously enough, a universal vogue.
Similar stories appear everywhere in the world. And yet, there was never the Garden of Eden. There was never a universal flood. We have to ask, how are we to read these stories? Now, what I'm going to suggest is that by comparing the different stories in different parts of the world, in different traditions, we can unshell the original sense of these things. They did not originally have a specifically historical sense. They were directed to another problem. They were metaphors through which man learned to relate himself to eternal things, to find the permanent, the enduring, the valuable aspect of his experience, and to concentrate upon and develop in his life that aspect of his experience. Let us regard for a moment the picture of the Garden of Eden. It was an enclosed garden. Paradise actually is a Persian word that refers to an enclosed garden. And in the center was the great tree. There were, in fact, two trees, tree of knowledge and the tree of immortal life. And there were four rivers flowing in the four directions. And this was the beginning, the navel, the central point of the universe. Now, this dear couple, our first parent, ate of the tree. And then we hear from the Lord, lest they should eat of the second tree and become as gods, become divine, let us expel them from the garden. Now, how many people, when they read that, realize what God said? God said, lest they should eat of the tree of immortality and become as gods. This means it is possible for man to become divine. That means to experience his own divinity within. But in this story, man is expelled from the garden, and a cherub, an angel with a flaming sword, is stationed at the gate to keep man away from the tree that is in the center. Now let me move from that first chapter in the Old Testament to the story of the Christian image. Here we are told that Christ on the cross brought man immortality. Now it is a fact that throughout the Middle Ages and in the legendary of the Christian tradition, this mystery of the cross is equated with the mystery of the second tree in the garden. There are many legends that call the cross the holy tree and Christ upon it, the fruit of the tree of immortality. There is also a very pretty legend. The hill on which the crucifixion took place is called Calvary, also Golgotha. This word means the skull, the hill of the skull. Whose skull was there? The legend is that it was Adam's skull, that the cross was planted on Adam's skull as though it had grown from the fall of man, this tree of the redemption. And Christ's redeeming blood fell on that skull, and through that mankind was redeemed. But the point I want to make right now is that since Adam's skull was there, this is the garden again. This was thought of as the midpoint of the world. And it is just as though Christ had guided us through that door of Eden, past the guardian at the gate, to the tree of immortality. Now, in the way in which this imagery is interpreted in the Old Testament and New Testament traditions, the reason man was expelled was because he disobeyed. And we say that by the cross, man was atoned. So we have a mythology, we have an imagery based on the ideas of obedience and disobedience. That is to say, the relationship of a child to parent. By this way of interpreting the symbols, man is maintained in an attitude of childlike devotion and dependency to the divinity. Now I want to shift our point of view to the Orient. There too we have a tree. And that tree is exactly the tree of immortal life and illumination. It is the tree under which the Buddha sat. The imagery is exactly equivalent to the imagery of the Garden of Eden. When you read the Indian or Buddhist legends of the Buddha and compare them with the legendary of the Old Testament and New Testament traditions, you realize we're in the same garden, the same tree. You remember there was a serpent in that garden, and there's a serpent in the Buddha's garden, too. But instead of the serpent being regarded as evil, that serpent who represents the life on earth, who crawls on his belly on the lovely surface of Mother Earth, the serpent in the Buddhist story is the support of the earth. His head is right under that tree. He supports it. And when the Buddha is sitting there in deep meditation and rapture, and the storm comes up, the serpent comes up and protects the Buddha. You've seen that image. That's the same serpent, same tree, and it's man under the tree. But instead of man staying out of the garden, he goes in, so that the Buddha is equivalent to the Christ figure. There are many, many parallels between these two biographies. It doesn't matter from the standpoint now of interpreting these in terms of their spiritual reference, whether the Buddha ever lived or whether Christ ever lived, whether the Buddha ever did this or Christ ever did that. The point is, what is the meaning of the image? Now, when we read the Oriental story of this legendary, the thing that keeps us out of the garden is not disobedience. It is ignorance. The fact that our senses, directed out into the world of time and space, attach us to the mere surfaces of things and fill us with fears and desires in relation to the mortal aspect of the world. This is the fact that keeps us out of the garden. We, according to this doctrine, do not need any cherub with a flaming sword to keep us out. We're keeping ourselves out simply by our interest in the mere mortal aspect of our existence and the world's existence. And what one does by passing through that gate is to pass through the gate of the senses, so to say. And there are many mythological images that render this mystery, so that we realize that the Savior, the hero, the redeemed one, is the one who has learned to penetrate the wall of space and time that surrounds us, to penetrate the floor of his own emotions, and to find in this world and in himself those enduring, permanent values that in here, in the very act of living itself. Now, I remember hearing at a marriage ceremony, the clergyman say, live in such a way that in the next life, you will experience eternal life. And immediately I translated that into what seemed to me to be the proper mythological term. Live in such a way that in this life, you will experience eternal life. Because there are these eternal things that men have lived for and in with experience. We all have the privilege of experiencing these as the great heritage that the world gives us as human beings. And the myths help us see what they are. They are the metaphors. They are those little guiding signals that guide our attention through the wall of the mortal to the eternal. Now this wonderful image of the garden, the tree, in the Buddhist tradition it's called the immovable spot. That spot that you come to when you are not distracted by fear and desire for the transitory. You come then to the permanent point. This myth and this whole system of images is shared, as I've just pointed out, by the Great Orient, by the Great, Great Occident. Read in two quite different ways. One way, in terms of a child's relationship to his parent, disobedience and atonement. Another, in terms simply of a psychological rather than a pedagogical imagery. But the images themselves are older than either tradition. They go way, way back. Much older than the Old Testament, much older than Buddhism, much older than India. We find them in the earliest Mesopotamian tradition, the old Sumerian tradition, and back then in the primitive world. Now what I want to do next is tell you something about how we know what the early myths thought of man were, what the evidence is for man's earliest mythological thinking, and come down then to our present. Few brief essential clues. There was a great, great crisis when mankind learned how to cultivate food instead of simply going out and searching for it. Planting your crops and domesticating your animal food. This occurred in the Near East about 8,000 BC. And from that center, these two arts of agriculture and animal husbandry were diffused gradually to the rest of the earth. Before that time, man foraged for his food, hunting and grubbing for it. And in those first days, there were only very tiny, small communities. What is the antiquity of man? As I've said, this agricultural system comes in about 8,000 BC. But as you probably know, within the past few years, in the Olduvai Gorge in East Africa, there have been found the evidences of human or human-like skulls, which now are being dated 1,800,000 years ago. That's a long, long time. And for all those years, men were in small groups, a minority in this world. We are now a great majority. The community that we have to live with is largely a human community, and it's man facing man today. But in those days, men hardly ever met other men. They were dealing with the animal world all the time. And so the other, that mystery person whom you had to deal with, was an animal. And so the same kind of immediacy of relationship that we have with our alien neighbors, men then had with the animals, and the animals were the immediate neighbors with whom one had to make relationships. And this problem of relationship of this group to that group, which now dominates our whole political life, was a dominant theme in the mythologies of those times. The first evidences we have, I mean real tangible evidences, of ritual life among human beings occurs in the period known as that of Neanderthal man. And this dates from about 200,000 BC, just before the last of the Ice Ages. The evidence is in the form of hand axes. You know, these sometimes beautifully shaped stone tools. Some of these hand axes, beautifully shaped indeed, are as great as 2 feet long. Now that means that nobody ever used it as a tool. There were tool hand axes, but this is a ceremonial axe. And where you have a ceremonial axe, you have a ceremony of some kind. And what would the ceremony be? It would be a ceremony in relationship to the carving up or cutting of food. This business of the nourishment of the community from killed animals. The next bit of evidence, that's the first clue we have to ritual life in human existence. I placed it too late. I said Neanderthal man. This goes all the way back actually to Pithecanthropus, perhaps 400,000 BC. It's in Neanderthal times, 200,000, that the great evidence appears. This is the evidence of burial. It is in the period of Neanderthal man that we find burials. Burials with grave gear, with tools, with food. And what does this mean? This means that there is the notion of another life. This means there is the problem of an immortal in relation to a mortal existence. Another bit of evidence that occurs in exactly this period are shrines in very high caves, shrines where there are cave bear skulls, many cave bear skulls in little shrines with stones set around them and so forth, as though the cave bear were an object of awe and reverence. Now we have among certain primitive people in the north, in the Arctic regions, and among our American Indians, bear cults, and the head of the bear is very often treated in just the way in which it is in these early Neanderthal cave situations. Particularly interesting are the bear cults of the Ainu people of northern Japan. These are Caucasoid people, older than the Japanese, who lived in the islands of Japan before the Japanese came. They have a bear cult. I won't describe it at length, more than to say that they have little pet bears. When they find little bear cubs, they take the cubs home, and bears play with the kids and so forth. But when the bear begins to get about 2 or 3 years old, it gets a little rough for the kids, so he's put in a cage. And then when he's about 4 years old, it's time to send him home. Home is heaven, of course. Now, the Ainus have the nicest notion about heaven and earth that I know, and it's this, that earth is a better place than heaven, and that the gods like to come here. And the gods, in order to pay us visits, put on animal suits, as it were. They come as animals, or as flowers, or as bugs. But the only difficulty is that when they get here, they can't take the suit off. So we have to help them. Now, when it comes time to send our little bear visitor home, who's been a great pet of the family, the person who has been his host addresses him. He says, now, in case you've never experienced one of these before, little divinity, you may think it a bit rough, but it's all meant very well. And we want you to go home and tell your parents in heaven how good we've been to you. And here's the point. If you have enjoyed life here with us, come again. And we'll give you the honor of another bear ceremony. So then they kill him, and they take his hide and put it on a kind of little scaffold, and they cry, and they give him a dinner. Guess what the dinner is? His own bear meat. They give him some of that to eat, and then very happy, he goes home. But remember this point. If you would only wish to come again, this means, and this is the great theme in these ceremonies, there is no death. Now that is a mythological theme that comes right down to the present. We talk about eternal life, and that is the theme of those two great Garden of Eden stories that I mentioned. The immortality that transcends the mortal world. And here we have it, signaled in these burials and bear shrines of Neanderthal man, 200,000 BC. There's theme number one. Well, we come to a later period, the period of great caves. You've seen the pictures of the beautiful bulls and animals on the cave walls. In this period, there appear the first art objects. Now, a cave bear skull is not an art object, and neither is a burial, and neither is a tool. But I mean art objects. The first art objects are little naked female figurines about 3 or 4 inches high, just standing there.
There she is, the doctor. And she doesn't have any feet. That's because the little figures were put into the earth and made to stand in little household shrines. Now, this motif of the female and the source of life, the giver of forms to the world, and the food and nourishment to the world, is a theme that comes down. We still speak of Mother Nature, Mother Earth. This is a personification of Mother Nature, Mother Earth. It is she in whose womb the dead are buried for rebirth. This is a basic theme in the mythologies. In the primitive mythologies, they're read in very simple terms, in terms of Mother Earth. In the later mythologies, they're read in very much more sophisticated terms, in terms of this great mystery of time and space, this veil of time and enveloping womb of space in which we live. That is the great mother of life. And the divine father of life pours his energy into this great space world. This is an image that comes right down through the mythologies and higher mythologies. You find this in Plato and in the great theologians of the Middle Ages. Whereas the female figure, when it appears in mythology, is represented normally as a nude, the woman in her own mystery and being, just being there is a power. When the males appear, they always appear in costume. They represent some specific social inflection. Now, Freud has told us this. In the child's experience, the mother represents the mystery of nature itself. She has brought the child forth, she nourishes the child, and then there's the image of the consuming mother who keeps the child back, the cannibal ogress, who is Mother Earth taking us back again. This is the prime image of nature as woman. But, says he, the father represents the authority of society. And so it is in the early myths as well. The male represents the authority of the social order. And in the great rituals in which a boy is initiated into the society's laws, he is taken away from his mother, brought to the men's grounds, and he is fed men's food, and that is spiritual food, the myths. And with the myths, very often, the men feed him on men's blood. Well, that was a rather wild ceremony. Now let me just tell what seems to be one of the rather charming little primitive myths from an American Indian tribe, the Blackfeet, giving some sense of the relationship of the society to the animal world through the woman and the animal. This is a story of a winter when the Indians, the Blackfeet Indians, were unable to kill any buffalo. They have a technique, they used to have a technique of scaring buffalo and making them stampede over a great rock wall called the Buffalo Fall, so that the buffalo all fell at the bottom of the wall and could be killed down there. They were all knocked out, in fact, broken, all this kind of thing. Well, every time the buffalo were being stampeded toward this Buffalo Fall, they turned away and wouldn't go over. So the tribe was going to be without any food that winter. Well, one morning, a young girl getting up early to go get the water for her family's wigwam, goes out and sees buffalo up there on the high plateau, just above the falls. And she looks and she says, "Oh, if you would only come over, I'd marry one of you." Well, why the hell? They all came up. Smash! One after another. And she was somewhat surprised. I mean, you say things like that, you don't expect it to happen. But the worst of it was, one great big old bull comes and he says, "All right, Billy, we're off." "Oh, no," she said. "Oh, yes," he said. Look what's happened here, and you're backing down." So he takes it by the arm, and off they go. You can never tell in these stories whether it's quite a human being or a buffalo. It's what's called a semi-human, semi-animal shaman. Well, he was the one, of course, that sent them over. This is the idea of the animal master, that there is a power, a spirit, that lets the animals through and takes them back again.
The animals simply give their bodies, if you, well, we'll come to that in a minute. Off he goes with the girl. Well, when Danny and Mama wake up, they say, where's little Minnehaha? And they, well, I don't know where she is, what's this? And they go out, and he sees what's happening. And of course, you know, Indians, they always know by footprints what's going on. He got the idea. So he goes in, puts his moccasins on, takes his bow and arrow. He's going out to get that buffalo. Off he goes. And after going a little way, he comes to a buffalo wallow. This is the place where buffalo like to roll around. And he thinks he has a sense of there being buffalo nearby. So he sits down to think what he should do. And he sees a magpie, beautiful black and white bird, pecking around. Now, magpies are very clever birds, and they're thought to be shaman birds. And he says, magpie, have you seen my daughter around here? How's this girl over there now? I said, would you just tell her that her daddy has come? And he says, all right. So over he goes, and there's the girl, her big buffalo bull. All the buffaloes are asleep. You know how buffaloes are. And she's sitting there kind of knitting or putting beads on something. And the magpie says, your father's over at the wallow. Oh, my goodness. Tell him to wait. Be careful, because this is very dangerous. Magpie. So he goes and tells him to wait. Big old buffalo wakes up. So he says, give me some water. Takes off one of his horns and do it. She'll get some water. So she goes to where the water is and she sees Daddy. And she says, this is come along. I don't want you to that old buffalo. So she fills the buffalo horn and brings it to the buffalo. And he says, be thankful for my smell of blood and ninja. And he roars. All the buffaloes get up and start stamping around and snorting. Then they go over where Daddy is and they just trample him out. He disappears, he's gone, they killed him. The girl starts to cry. So he says, so you're kind. Daddy. He says, you're kind because you lost your father, but think about it. Our children, our wives, all this is. And here you are. What is it? But he's my daddy. But he said, if you can bring your daddy back to life again, I'll let you and your daddy go home. All right. Well, she says to the magpie, do you think you can get your daddy? Go over and find him. So he goes over and he pecks around, and what do you know? He does find a bit of bone. She puts that bone down on the ground, puts a blanket over it, starts chanting a song. And presently we can see there's a man. She lifts up the blanket, looks, puts it down, and he's there, all right, but he's not alive yet. She sings some more, and she gets up. Buffaloes are quite amazed. What's with the old boy? You brought your daddy back to life. Why don't you bring us back to life? He said, now I'll make a little arrangement with you. If you will dance a buffalo dance and sing the buffalo song and return the buffalo blood to the earth, we will give you our bodies. Now, here we have these great themes. These are the themes dominant in the old hunting world. The animals are willing victims if you perform the correct ceremony. So these ceremonies constitute a kind of covenant between the world of the animal and the world of man, an accord between the source of man's life and the community. They involve the concept of no death, and there we are. Now, this is a basic myth of the so-called Buffalo Society, and we have evidence from the old caves, right back 60,000 BC, of buffalo dances of this kind and rites of this kind. Now, when we move from this world of this very primitive man to the world of the more developed societies, a great transformation takes place. These little societies had no concept of a great world order. I have a friend who was talking to some Indians in the Southwest, and there was an old Indian medicine man. And the old Indian medicine man said, you white people are pretty lucky that we Indians are still around. Well, he said, and why is that? He said, because it's our ceremonies that make the sun rise every morning and make the sun set every night. Well, you know how societies are. Each one thinks it's the one that holds the world up. But the point is that in these old primitive days, there was no notion of an inevitable cosmic order. However, with the invention of agriculture about 8,000 BC, larger communities can develop. And indeed, they do come into being. By about 4,000 years later, we have little cities. And in these cities, there are differentiated classes of men. There are specialists. There are governors. There are trading people. There are planting people. There are artisans. And there are professional priests. The professional priests are considered to watch the heavens for omens, and in order to know what the proper planting and reaping times would be. And they become aware of the planets, those little specks of light moving in a mathematically predictable order through the big stars. And it's at that time, about 3200 BC, that the concept comes into the world of a cosmic order. Now, the world is not held up by men. The world itself has an impersonal cosmic order with which man has to put himself into relation. And it is at this time that there comes the concept of the king with the crown of the sun or with the horns of the moon and the members of his court as comparable to the great planets. And just as there is the cycle of the day, the cycle of the year, so there is the cycle of the eon. And at certain mathematically predictable moments, the king and his court went into the ground and died, voluntarily departed. You know that book that was published a couple of years ago, The King Must Die. Well, in the 20s, whole courts buried in ceremonial attire were unearthed in the Near East. Here we have a very interesting. Just as the old primitive people were associating themselves with the mystery of the animal world, so these agriculturally based communities were coming into a link with the heavenly order. And you have a covenant now, not between man and the beasts, but between man and the heavenly constellations, the powers of the heavens. As it is in heaven, so shall it be on earth. We still celebrate our religious festival in accord with the dates of the year. Death, we think of in the time of the fall equinox. At midwinter, with the birth of the sun, we have the concept of the Christmas and the new life coming. At springtime, there is the resurrection. And in the Hebrew tradition, the Exodus, coming out of the abyss of Egypt just at the time of the sprouting spring. So our festivals are associated with the cosmic order. The society itself is a manifestation of this order, and the individual achieves his dignity by putting himself into relation to society. So the concept of this cosmic order is the concept that exists to this day in the Great Orient. The Great Oriental traditions are traditions derived from that old Bronze Age period. And it's from that period that the story of the garden comes. Obedience to the Lord of the world. Obedience to that sky father, you might say, as a child to a superior power. And in the Far East, the discovery of that law of being, which the Chinese call the Tao, the way of the universe. But now in our Occidental world, something else took place. And it took place in two great centers. One is the center of Greece, and the other is the center of Israel, of Judah. In both of these worlds, the concept of the willing personality comes in. In the Greek world, the dominant interest is in this wonderful creature, man, whose reason, whose mind, housed in this beautiful human body, is the noblest manifestation of the mystery of nature. Man, as a part of nature, is the noblest part of nature. We have a very strong humanistic tradition there. Because in the Hebrew tradition, the stress goes to the divine power, as though it were a personality. This is the tradition in which the ultimate mystery of the universe is personified as an all-subsuming and creating individual who decides to create. You don't have that in the other traditions. In the Orient, in the Deep Orient, and in the Old Bronze Age, there was never a creation. There was never a time when there was no world. There never will be an end. There is a continuous round, on and on, an incredible thing by day coming and going. And the gods are simply agents of that impersonal power. It is a ruthless, impersonal thing. This is the character that one has to watch for in association with the Oriental culture. It's the underlying theme, the theme of ruthless, inevitable impersonality with which man has to put himself into accord. Whereas in the two Western traditions, there is a notion of a will, a voluntary doing. And in the Hebrew tradition, this is attributed to a creator. And in the Greek tradition, it is attributed primarily to man. A characteristic of the Near East, the Levantine traditions, whether it is Zoroastrianism, Judaism, Christianity, or Islam, is for man to submit to the personality, the omnipotence of that great willing creator in fear and in reverence and in love. The characteristic of the Greek, on the other hand, is to cherish the human value. No Greek would ever say what Job said when God, having tortured him and abused him absolutely outrageously, shows himself. Job bows and says, "I am of little account. I have heard of thee with my ears, but I see thee now, and I cover my desk, my head with ashes." That submission of the human judgment to the majesty of the Creator is characteristic of the religion, the Levant. Prometheus, when Zeus treated him in the same way, said, "He's a brute. He's a savage. I despise him." He puts the human values above these others. Now, in our world today, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, we're with the Greeks. And then for half an hour, one day a week, we feel guilt for all that. And the next day, we go to the psychoanalyst to find out what's wrong. These two traditions have been brought together in us. In the biblical tradition, it's this theme, as I say, of guilt before the great Father and atonement with him. This is the biblical view. The Greek simply meets him and challenges him, and the tragic view is this: the value in the world is man. The value in the world is the beauty of the nobility and the elegance of man. But it will vanish. Nevertheless, I do not say, "Let it not be. What is man that thou shouldst think of it?" I say, "It passes, it is ephemeral, but that is the value, this is the tragic view." And we are between these worlds. Prometheus was the one who brought value to man. Prometheus pinned to the rock, Christ pinned to the cross, the Buddha under the tree. These are equivalent symbols. They are read in different ways. One great theme: beauty, man, mortal life, in relation to the great transcendent power. You can take this attitude towards that attitude, another attitude. But it is these symbols, these attitudes, that have served to guide man toward this relationship. And I would say, what does it matter whether one lives as a Greek, or as a Jew, or as a Hindu, or as a Chinese, so long as he's living in relationship to this mystery. The one who lives out of relationship to that, again, what does it matter? Whether he's a Greek, a Hebrew, a Hindu, or a Jew, or a Chinese. The great point is that through these forms, through this mode, that mode, or another, one is linked to what James Joyce called the grave and constant in human suffering. Linked not with a feeling of horror, nausea, or shock, but with the realization that somehow this is the value. I'm having students come to me these days saying, life has no meaning. We've read Herzog, and we find that it doesn't have a meaning. So this is very disappointing. Then this same lovely girl goes out of the office, and it's a beautiful day, and she's walking along, enjoying the lovely air and the lovely sunshine. She isn't asking herself at that moment, does this have a meaning? And it's just that you can't live all the time. And when she isn't living, she's asking what the meaning is. When you ask what the meaning is, that means the thing you're doing doesn't mean anything to you. If it's an end and value in itself, then you don't have to seek the meaning. The function of the myth is to show exactly that, that in every little thing, there is the ultimate. There's a wonderful statement that comes out of an old 12th century Hermetic book that was translated out of Greek into Latin. And it's this, that the divine, God himself, is a circle whose circumference is nowhere and whose center is everywhere. That is to say, this is it, my friend. And if you're not experiencing the eternal in the moment now, no point in waiting till another now later on after death. But the myths really tell us is not to wait, but to have it right in our own experience here and now. Not asking for the meaning, but finding it, knowing it, and making it. This is this talk.
So what about this title, Myth and Folklore? As you heard, there was no real reference to folklore, but it did appear in the guise of one of Professor Campbell's favorite stories, and that will become clear as we look at the difference between mythology and folklore. To begin with, folklore is a very broad category consisting of myths, legends, fairy tales, jokes, superstitions, dances, and more. It describes how people cope with everyday life, their values, and local customs. Folklore may involve a wide range of characters, including regular local people. Sometimes they're historical, or animals, or local supernatural phenomena and creatures. Folklore, then, is the entire body of traditional belief, stories, customs, and art shared by a group and passed down orally. Mythology tends to be about a particular type of narrative folklore. The stories of myth are highly specific. They're often written down. They're foundational narratives that a culture holds as a profound truth. Mythic narratives offer a grand scope and tackle the biggest questions humans can ask. Where do we come from? Why is the world organized this way? What happens when we die? These questions have a sacred quality and are often intrinsically tied to a culture's religion or spiritual worldview. They aren't just entertainment. They're not just so stories. They're a community's reality created by some cosmic authority like gods, goddesses, or primordial beings. To put it broadly and perhaps inelegantly, folklore is like the category fruit, and myths are like the category apples. All apples are fruit, but not all fruit is an apple. Therefore, if you study Blackfeet cosmology, which sees the universe as interconnected, with power flowing from the sun, Natusi, and pervading all realms, earth, sky, and water, involving divine beings, spirits, and reciprocal relationships between humans and nature that emphasize sacred cycles, spiritual renewal through vision quests, and ceremonies that honor the sun and cosmic connections. You're studying both mythology, which is composed of what we might call sacred narratives, and folklore, the general container of traditional oral culture. When you study their traditional lore regarding magical stones or animal masters, as Professor Campbell relates near the end of this lecture, you're hearing folklore. Let's get back to Campbell's lecture. We have listened to Campbell in his element, at the Cooper Union, on the platform, introducing a lecture series called The Emergence of Mankind, a stunningly broad topic that ranges across the history of humankind. And it is just the sort of topic that Campbell can articulate and tantalize us with a reasonably concise introductory talk covering the emergence of Homo sapiens in what Prospero called the dark, backward, an abysm of time, that murky, indistinct depth of the past and memory, to present conceptions of human value in various religious traditions. I think it's fair to say, with all respect to Campbell, that with modern advances in anthropology and archaeology, much has changed regarding what we know about other hominin species and how they thought. First of all, his statement that man hardly met other men during the Paleolithic or Neolithic periods is really questionable in my mind. There were, after all, surprising numbers of hominin species living alongside each other. While I don't disagree with Campbell when he says that animals were the most immediate neighbors with which man had to deal, the Smithsonian Museum's Human Origins Program lists at least 21 different hominin species recognized by most scientists, all of which existed before or alongside Homo sapiens. Human evolution was not a single linear progression. Our family tree is not a linear sequence, but a complex bush with many branches and many interactions among them, even though most led to extinction. For much of our history, multiple hominin species coexisted on Earth. Around 300,000 years ago, when Homo sapiens sapiens first emerged, there were as many as 8 other hominin species already wandering around. Around 60,000 years ago, Homo sapiens shared the planet with at least 5 other known species. And genetic evidence shows that Homo sapiens interbred with some of those other species, like Neanderthals and Denisovans, meaning that their legacy lives on in the DNA of a surprising number of modern humans. The findings of modern anthropology indicate that the psychology of many extinct hominin species, particularly Neanderthals and Denisovans, were remarkably similar to that of Homo sapiens. Similar enough, anyway, that a great deal of successful inbreeding occurred between the 3 species. Not the least of these similarities, and perhaps most importantly for our purposes, was symbolic thought. Neanderthals made jewelry from shells and eagle talons and created simple forms of cave art, indicating an appreciation for aesthetics and symbolic expression beyond mere survival needs. Empathy and altruism were also shared emotional capacities. Fossil evidence such as the Neanderthal man who survived significant disabling injuries, including an atrophied arm and partial blindness and deafness, suggests that community care and compassion existed so that he would have the required support from others to survive. It's surprising, at least to me it's surprising, to learn that the skeletal structure of Neanderthal ears suggests an auditory and speech capacity similar to modern humans, supporting the idea that they possessed the capacity for a complex language. Given this capacity, It doesn't seem far-fetched to imagine some of these early hominins learning to communicate with each other, particularly in familial settings. After all, we see this constantly in our own contemporary world. Individuals from different cultures and languages backgrounds successfully assimilate to a new culture and a new language. Despite the similarities, scientific consensus points to some differences too. Take social complexity, for example. Some research suggests that the structure of the Homo sapien brain, particularly the larger cerebellum and frontal regions relative to the visual cortex, allowed for larger, more complex social networks, greater adaptability, and, I would argue, a more wide-ranging imagination. These abilities may have given Homo sapiens a critical advantage in innovation and abstract reasoning. In essence, we continue to function psychologically much as we did 300,000 years ago, with relatively the same big brains, those same imaginations, facing the same complexities of how best to live a human life. In his marvelous book, Out of Our Minds, What We Think and How We Came to Think It, the historian Felipe Fernandez Armesto argues that many of our most important ideas have ancient roots predating written history, and that they are often recycled and reinterpreted over time. By way of example, he writes, the same rational, imaginative abilities invented the atlatl as well as the iPhone, unquote. Ultimately, the success of Homo sapiens as the sole surviving human species wasn't due to a single sudden evolutionary leap, but rather a series of small cumulative advantages across multiple domains. We evolved as general specialists, one might say, demonstrating the behavioral flexibility and adaptability to thrive in diverse environments, unlike the other hominins like Neanderthals, who were highly specialized for cold climates and struggled when conditions changed. This flexibility of Homo sapiens was facilitated by our highly complex social networks. We lived in larger, more interconnected groups that allowed for the crucial sharing of resources and information over vast distances during times of scarcity. Paired with this was an advanced capacity for complex language, enabling cooperative communication to coordinate activities like large-scale hunting. Finally, our rapid technological innovation, including projectile weapons and better clothing, combined with reproductive instincts that supported higher population densities and gave us the decisive edge. Ultimately, these biological, social, and technological advantages coalesced, securing our success largely through sheer numbers alone. Professor Campbell mentioned that which in the mid-1960s was a common misunderstanding, that the ritual arrangement of bear skulls in caves was evidence that Neanderthals may have worshipped the cave bear. This is one of those moments where listening to Campbell requires a kind of epistemological generosity. He was working with the best anthropological theories available to him in the early 60s, ideas that have since been substantially revised and in some cases abandoned altogether. Modern anthropology now suggests that what was once called a cult of the cave bear was almost certainly a romantic fiction. The idea emerged in the early 1920s, proposed independently by at least two excavators working in cave bear dens. By the mid-70s, however, a detailed analysis had appeared that systematically dismantled the evidence for such a cult. And yet, despite this, best-selling novels, major Hollywood films, and even college textbooks have continued to treat the cave bear cult as an established fact. Why? Well, because the story is simply too good, too compelling, too wondrous. The original excavation that fueled the theory took place between 1917 and 1921, in a cave high above Switzerland's Tamina Valley. There, a researcher named Emil Bachler uncovered what appeared to be an extraordinary find. Cave bears, we know, used caves for hibernation, and over centuries, their deaths left behind vast quantities of bones. But some of what Bachler's workmen discovered seemed, at least at first glance, unnatural. Low stone walls ran along parts of the cave interior. Beneath them were accumulations of bear bones. Where walls appeared, bones appeared. Where they didn't, bones were scarce. And even more striking was the skull of a bear found upright between two shin bones, with a thigh bone pushed through a gap in the skull itself. To Bachler, these deposits seemed to serve no practical purpose. They seemed to have a staged quality that suggested ritual. And so ritual is what he saw. But archaeology in the early 20th century was very different from the discipline it is today. Excavations were often carried out by hired workmen, not trained specialists. Detailed measurements, photographs, stratigraphic drawings, now standard practices, were rarely made. Bachler himself was not continuously present at the site. He wasn't even there when the most spectacular find, that skull pierced by the thigh bone, was uncovered. No measured drawings were made of the walls or bone deposits. In fact, very little was documented at all. Now, there's no reason to suspect bad faith on Bachler's part, but there is reason to believe that interpretation shaped memory. Sketches he made in the 20s differ markedly from those he produced decades later, and the differences suggest that his recollections evolved in the direction of his theory. What he remembered increasingly reflected what he believed he had seen. Later research showed that the evidence could be explained entirely by natural processes. When cave bears entered a cave to hibernate, they scratched nesting hollows into the cave floor, pushing bones and stones aside. These materials often fell into crevices between fallen rocks, where they accumulated and were protected from trampling and decay. Over time, roof collapses naturally sealed those pockets beneath slabs of limestone. Bone concentrations behind rock formations are not mysterious at all. They're precisely what one would expect. Even the famous skull pierced by a thigh bone has natural precedence. In sites predating any human presence in Europe, paleontologists have found bones interlocked in improbably dramatic ways. When thousands of bones are moved about over centuries by hundreds of animals, statistical inevitability alone guarantees occasionally stunning arrangements. One researcher found a cave bear skull with a pebble lodged in its nostril, flanked by two neatly parallel bones, an arrangement as striking as anything Bachler reported, and yet entirely accidental. Despite the mitigating evidence, the cave bear cult narrative endures. No doubt part of its appeal lies in its compatibility with other discoveries. Intentional Neanderthal burials, for instance, decorated objects that suggest symbolic or ritual behavior. In fact, many anthropologists believe that the biological difference between Neanderthals and modern humans are relatively slight, and that their inner lives may have been recognizably human, even spiritual. We perpetuate these untrue stories. We do that because we have an innate thirst for meaning. That, and we simply love a good story. We prefer, it seems, narratives that turn singularities into ubiquities, prosaic coincidences into romance, and fact into stimulating fantasy. We are profoundly uncomfortable with chaos, with ambiguity and indifference. And the raw facts of the world are messy and resistant to narrative. We'd prefer that random accidents were the result of intention We would rather see patterns than chaos, and we would rather believe something that feels right, truthiness, as Stephen Colbert said, rather than the cool logic of fact. Romantic explanations offer the welcome relief of certainty in an uncertain world. To discover the secret to finding meaning in life is among the deepest of human yearnings, and the romantic escape from cold rational fact and evidentiary materialism seems to affirm the primacy of the inner world, the primacy of an ego, a self, which can harness creative power and transform reality into something beautiful and profound. The poet Philip Larkin wrote, "To prove our almost instinct almost true, what will survive of us is love." And I guess if we can't have love, we'll take devotion. Well, thank you for listening to another episode of Pathways with Joseph Campbell. It continues to be a genuine pleasure for me to provide these lectures and commentary. Please remember to check out our other podcasts on the Mythmaker Podcast Network at our Joseph Campbell Foundation website, jcf.org. And if you're interested in my own work, you can find me at bradleyolsonphd.com and discover what's mything in your life. Thank you again, and I'll be back next month with another rarely heard Joseph Campbell lecture from our archives.
Pathways with Joseph Campbell is a production of the Joseph Campbell Foundation and the Mythmaker Podcast Network. It is produced by Tyler Lapkin. Executive producer, John Booker. Your host has been Bradley Olson. Editing and audio services provided by Tristan Batt. All music exclusively provided by APM Music. For more podcasts and information about Joseph Campbell, please visit jcf.org.